Hello, friends. Welcome back to Love Will Tear Us Apart, a podcast on your favorite complicated couples. This episode is part two of the wild saga of Tina and Ike Turner. In last week's episode, I explored both Tina and Ike's origins in the rural South, their meeting in East St. Louis, and the first few years of their relationship and musical career. I also left off on the beginnings of Ike's physical, mental, and sexual abuse. Tina admits that she loved Ike in the very beginning, and while I'm not a psychiatrist, one might draw the conclusion that Tina suffered a form of Stockholm syndrome. Ike bought a house for her mother. He would buy Tina fancy coats and cars, even though she wasn't allowed to have her own money. And he was the reason why she was famous. It's easy to assume that Tina, who thinks of herself as an optimist, tried to find the best light to view her relationship in. But each year she stayed with Ike, a little piece of her died. She's also said that fear is what made her stay. As their career began taking off, the beatings and sexual violence got worse. "I'd be on stage trying to sing through these cuts and swollen lips," Tina said. Not only was the abuse bad, but Ike had girlfriends everywhere, and he didn't try to hide them from Tina. In fact, they were often brought into their inner circle and given a job or a place to live, and Ike would physically abuse them too. While Tina didn't like a few of these women, she also developed close bonds with many of them. One night in 1962, Ike asked Tina to marry him. She didn't want to marry this abusive man, but she was afraid to say no. Saying no only caused more trouble. So the two of them, with a bunch of band members in tow, drove down to Tijuana to get a quickie marriage. Then Ike took Tina to a sex show. He wasn't even divorced from his previous wife. In 1964, Ike bought a home in Los Angeles, and the couple brought out Tina's son, Craig, and Ike's two children from St. Louis. There was now a family of six living there, with band members, strangers, and girlfriends coming and going. One such girlfriend was Ann Thomas, whom Ike met at a show and promoted to one of the Ikeettes. They quickly began an affair, and she moved into their home. Tina didn't outwardly disapprove of their relationship at first. She and Ann developed a close relationship, and she turned a blind eye when Ike and Ann would have sex in their house. "Sometimes I'd see him fooling around with one of the Ikeettes or picking up women from the audience at a show, and he'd send me home early," she wrote in her autobiography. Ike believes Tina was cool with all of this, and at times Tina acted like she was, but she admits to being jealous and hurt. And deep down, she knew Ike would never change. He might go out shopping and come back with tons of boxes, diamonds, fur coats, all kind of presents. It was like Christmas. But then a little while later, I'd see an Ikeette or one of his women walking by wearing the same thing he had just bought me, Tina said. Ann attempted to take Tina's place, and one day when Tina caught her and her husband having sex in their marital bed, Tina tried to kill Ann. "The only thing that stopped me was the house shoes I was wearing and the slippery floor. I grabbed that girl and I was reaching for a hammer, but I kept slipping and sliding all over the place," Tina said. At one point, Ann and Tina were both pregnant by Ike. Tina opted to terminate her pregnancy, and Ann gave birth to Ike's daughter, Mia, in 1969. Side note, Mia was very close to Ike and often publicly disputes Tina's claims of abuse at the hands of Ike. So throughout their marriage, Ike had multiple girlfriends at once, or had affairs with friends' wives or random strangers. In his autobiography, he talks of helping a friend out by having sex with a woman and then letting his friend take his place without letting the woman know. At one point, a desperate Tina tried to leave Ike and bus to her mother's house in St. Louis, which is seen in What's Love Got to Do with It. But Ike tracked her down and made her get off the bus, and he beat her with a wire hanger when they got home. It was like a horror movie. That's what my life had become, Tina said. By the late 1960s, the Ike and Tina Turner Review was moving along, but still hadn't reached the big time. Ike had the band constantly touring, with very few days off, and the Turners barely saw their children. When they were home, Tina had to clean the house. Though they headlined for the Rolling Stones during their UK tour, most of their singles barely cracked the top 100. The constant traveling, the abuse, the girlfriends, and being away from her children started to catch up to Tina, and she decided she wanted to end her life. One night, before a show in Los Angeles, Tina downed 50 Valium pills. She says the reason why she took them before the show was because if she passed out on stage, Ike would still get paid. But she never made it to the stage. In the dressing room, she began mumbling and putting makeup all over her face. Their manager, Rhonda, and Ike threw Tina into the car and rushed her to the hospital as Tina drifted in and out of consciousness. At the hospital, they pumped her stomach, but it was touch and go for a bit. Finally, she started to come to as Ike softly condemned her for being chicken shit and breaking her promise to him. When she woke up, Tina was disappointed she had survived and to see Ike standing over her. She said, "I knew my suicide attempt hadn't been a classic cry for help. I'd chosen death." Ike made her go right back to work, and it was then that Tina admits she hated Ike Turner. The 1970s started out well for Ike and Tina Turner. They had a chart-topping success with their covers of the Beatles' Come Together, Sly and the Family Stone's I Wanna Take You Higher, and lastly, one of their biggest hits, Proud Mary by Creedence Clearwater Revival. They also had a successful run in Vegas, but Tina found herself again in the hospital, this time with tuberculosis. All the wear and tear Ike had put her through was taking its toll. It took years for her to completely recover. Ike was becoming increasingly more tyrannical, turning their house into a sort of sleazy sex den and building an expensive Scarface-inspired recording studio nearby. Though the studio was used by famous musical acts such as the Rolling Stones and Frank Zappa, it was filled with guns, drugs, and a constant rotation of women. He had a secret bedroom where he'd film his sexual encounters with women and not tell them. In his biography, he boasts about having sex with 8 women at one time in that room. He admits to feeling kind of bad about making Tina sad over the affairs, but he put the burden on her to tell him to stop. Until now, Ike had stayed away from drugs. In fact, he took the role of band leader pretty seriously, so he didn't have patience for recreational activities such as drug use. However, when he got his first taste of cocaine in the early 70s, he became an eager connoisseur, and the drug would haunt him for the rest of his life. In his autobiography, Ike feels it's cocaine that broke up his marriage with Tina. You know, it wasn't the abuse or infidelity or anything like that. As the decade progressed, Tina and Ike's fame plateaued, and Ike spent sleepless nights strung out on cocaine in his new studio. He'd sometimes forget to eat, and Tina would spoon-feed him while he slept. He'd call Tina down day and night to sing whenever he wanted her to, and nothing she ever did was good enough. He often said to her, "What did you ever do for me?" And one time he threw hot coffee on her face, causing third-degree burns. Tina was in her mid-30s now, and she was trying to figure out a way to leave Ike. It was around this time she got into Buddhism. A girlfriend of Ike's told her about it, and it helped Tina get through this difficult time in her life. She's been a Buddhist ever since. In 1975, she starred as the Acid Queen in The Who's Tommy, and the experience gave her even more confidence to eventually leave Ike. She always felt in his shadow that he was the one who pulled the strings, but she was finally coming into her own. After Tommy, Tina attempted to leave Ike multiple times, but he always found her, and he usually beat her for leaving. The final straw came during a show in Dallas, Texas, and this scene's included in the film What's Love Got to Do with It. So the band landed in Texas, and Ike and Tina were fighting, except this time Tina was fighting back. When they arrived to their hotel, bloody, the couple went to their room, where Tina tended to Ike until he fell asleep. She looked at him while sleeping and said, "You just beat me for the last time, you sucker." She ran across the street to another hotel, and with 36 cents in her hand, she asked the manager if she could get a room. "I'm Tina Turner. I had a fight with my husband. Will you give me a room? I can't pay you now, but I promise I will." The manager obliged, and the next day, Tina flew back to LA, away from Ike, for good. She successfully left Ike Turner 2 nightmarish decades later. But she knew Ike would be looking for her, so she moved from one friend's house to another, helping with chores and cleaning as a thank you for letting her stay with them. Ike did finally track her down, but she called the police and they escorted him away. Ike pleaded with her to meet. She finally agreed. "Oh, I was strong by then. Strong," she said. "He showed up in a car with his driver and I got in. He could have done anything to me that he wanted, but he wasn't able to. He just sat there fumbling with his hat, and I saw fear in him. Real fear. I had always been under his thumb, but now I was strong. I was my own person, and he had never dealt with me on that level. He saw now that he had absolutely no control over me anymore, that I had outgrown my fear. And that scared him." Ike struggled with Tina leaving him. Their sons, who were still living with Ike, said he was irritable, sad, and abusive towards them. Finally, Ike sent all 4 of them to live with Tina, where she struggled to deal with the emotional toll their atypical upbringing had caused. Tina had $0. Ike had always managed and kept their money, and now Tina was broke and on food stamps. As the divorce proceedings dragged on, Ike began threatening Tina. Even the local police warned Tina that Ike was overheard wanting to kill her. It wasn't uncommon for one of Tina's friends' houses to be set on fire or gunshots to be blasted through the window of wherever Tina was sleeping. Finally, Tina had enough. She decided to walk away from the divorce with nothing but her name, 2 Jaguars, and a couple of songwriting credits. In 1978, after 21 years that brought fame and unspeakable emotional and physical abuse, Tina was finally free of Ike. She was 39 years old and raising 4 sons. What was she to do now? Most of us know the Tina Turner of the 1980s. The beautiful, smiling woman with a giant ombre wig singing about private dances and the Thunderdome. But it took a while for Tina to get to this stage of fame after leaving Ike. For years, she performed in lounges mostly around the Las Vegas area and did the occasional TV guest appearance on Hollywood Squares. She signed with manager Roger Davies, who booked her in small venues across the country. It would be a gig at New York City's famous The Ritz in 1983 that would change everything for Tina. Her old friend Mick Jagger showed up, as did Andy Warhol, David Bowie, Robert De Niro, and Diana Ross. Tina's show was the hottest ticket to catch, and she blew the roof off. Capitol Records signed her immediately, and her solo career took flight. While Tina's star was rising, Ike's was drowning. Not only was his music career dead, he was in major debt. He also had numerous run-ins with the law, most notably for shooting a newspaper delivery man in 1981 and for selling cocaine. Finally, his rap sheet caught up with him, and in 1991, he was sentenced to 4 years in prison. He was released after 18 months on good behavior, and he tried to live a clean life. Around this time, the film What's Love Got to Do with It, based off of Tina's 1986 autobiography, I, Tina, came out. Needless to say, Ike wasn't a fan of the film. He went on the interview circuit to defend why he had to hit Tina. So this is one of the things he said. She'd be walking around looking sad with her lip drooped, and I'd keep asking her, "Ann, what is the matter with you? What's wrong?" It was always nothing, and it would go on for a day or two until finally, smack! "Why the fuck don't you?" And then this is when I'd slap her or something. And then she'd change her mood or attitude. Let me tell you, I'll say this. I do no more to Tina, and I did no more to Tina than I'd want someone to do to my own mother. The film made Ike feel like a victim. He said, "I love Anna Mae Bullock, but this woman now, I don't like, I don't love, I don't want no part of," he said. "She's like a devil or something. It's not the one I know." Ike believes that Tina is only where she is because of him. And he also said he didn't leave any lasting scars on her. In his biography, Ike explains that blame should be equally shared in a marriage. In other words, if he's hitting Tina, it's 50% her fault because she hasn't left him. And if she's upset about the affairs or upset at him, then she needed to speak up. What he leaves out is that no one could speak up to Ike Turner. Otherwise, you'd get torn down emotionally and or physically. Ike was never able to recapture the fame and money he experienced during the Ike and Tina Turner review days. His drug abuse and run-ins with the law depleted his money, and when he wasn't in prison, he'd tour with various Ikettes or Tina lookalikes to little fanfare. While the majority of society thought ill of Ike because of Tina's revelations, many in the music business still saw him as a pioneer in the blues and rock and roll worlds. He and Tina were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he couldn't go because he was in prison. And Ike also played festivals such as South by Southwest. He was nominated for a Grammy in 2007 for his blues album Rising with the Blues, and he was sampled by artists such as Salt-N-Pepa and Jurassic 5. In Ike's autobiography, Little Richard credits Ike as being his role model. At the end of his life, Ike's 14th ex-wife, Audrey Madison Turner, said that Ike was diagnosed and treated for bipolar disorder. In her book, Love Had Everything to Do with It, she said, "One minute we're talking, and the next he'd slap me. And then just as quickly, he was apologizing, and we were both making excuses for why he did it." She said she pushed Ike to get treatment, and she wrote the book to shed light on his mental health issues. Though Ike was ailing from emphysema, he died at the age of 76 in 2007 from what the coroner said was a cocaine overdose. Tina had this to say about Ike's death. "Tina hasn't had any contact with Ike in more than 30 years. No further comment will be made." Since Ike's death, Tina's been a little more reflective on her history with him. In her latest autobiography, My Love Story, Tina explains that time has given her objectivity. She said, "When I think about Ike all these years later, I try to understand. The older I grow and the longer I'm away from him, the more clearly I can see Ike. You can analyze a person when you have that kind of distance, and that's what I've been doing, looking for the reasons behind his behavior, trying to figure out where he was coming from, telling myself, oh, that's why he did what he did. In that 2019 New York Times feature, when asked about Ike, Tina said, I don't know if I could ever forgive all that Ike ever did to me, but Ike's dead, so we don't have to worry about him. While Tina's post-Ike life certainly glowed, that doesn't mean she wasn't without her heartaches. In the past decade, Tina has suffered a stroke, kidney failure, intestinal cancer, and vertigo. Her husband, Erwin, donated one of his kidneys, which most likely saved her life. In 2018, her son with Raymond Hill, Craig, committed suicide. She tweeted a photo of her scattering his ashes on the Pacific coast with the caption, My saddest moment as a mother. He was 59 when he died so tragically, but he will always be my baby. Right before Craig's death, her adopted son, Ike Jr., was critical of Tina in the Daily Mail, saying she and Ike were absent parents, even though Tina was always financially supportive. He also said his parents' fights were normal and that he wishes Tina had made peace with Ike before he died. One thing I've noticed while researching this episode is that people either align themselves with Team Tina or Team Ike, and some believe Tina has overblown Ike's abuse or has become a snob who has moved on from the people in her past, including her children. While I'm neither judge nor jury, it's difficult for one to think Tina is lying. What would she have to gain from it? People in their orbit saw the abuse, and many of Ike's girlfriends or wives experienced the abuse. While Tina and Ike's story is certainly a big one, I would never call it a love story. There is nothing charming or romantic about their relationship. It is a tragic story, filled with years of sadness and abuse. And though Tina was under Ike's thumb for almost 20 years, in the end, she came out on top. This episode was researched, written, and recorded by me, Lauren Modry. Music was created by Mike G. Mike G also produced this episode. And I'd like to give a special thanks to Jonathan Luna and Jeff Marslett. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts.